If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 341. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about mountains and glaciers and fjords as we go to the South Island of New Zealand. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have four news stories for you. The first one, obviously, is the sad news that's coming out of the Middle East, especially Libya this week, where the American ambassador and three others were killed. Don't believe everything you hear in the news. Not everyone who is Muslim hates us. I hope you heard that the ambassador was rushed to the hospital by passersby, and doctors tried to revive him for half an hour. But unfortunately, there is going to be more violence, I think, in the Middle East. So if you're traveling in that area, please pay attention to travel advisories. And then as long as we're talking about sad or macabre stories, police were investigating a dead man found in London's street and are coming to the conclusion that the man may have fallen from a plane, that he may have been a stowaway who fell from a plane to his death. And I swear to you that I have seen this story before on a made-for-TV cop show. And then speaking of cop shows, an escaped murderer was arrested in Germany when he happened to come in on a cruise ship. The male passenger, an Austrian, had wrongly assumed he was untouchable by German police as long as he didn't get off the ship because of the ship's foreign registry. That turns out to be not the case, and he is in custody. But despite one less passenger, it turns out that the cruise ship business is jumping. Almost 2 million more people, or 10% more, took cruises last year than in 2010. For links to all four of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Eric Smith, who's come to talk to us about the South Island of New Zealand. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
And I say welcome back. This is, we figured out, your fifth time back. And if we have it correct, you've been on the show talking about national parks in general, the Four Corners area of the Southwest U.S., Yellowstone and Grand Tetons National Park, as well as the state of Michigan, your home state.
Yep. My first international one, though.
So we have interrupted your quest to see all the national parks. You were on a quest to do that until you started listening to the Amateur Traveler, and I feel somewhat guilty that we have screwed that up a bit and gotten you off to see the Holy Lands, and now I don't know if we at all were responsible for you going down to New Zealand, but you spent a month down in New Zealand.
I did. I did spend a month in New Zealand, and yeah, it was the initial episode on Israel of the Amateur Traveler that inspired that trip back in 2010. I did spend a month in New Zealand. I spent the first two-thirds on the South Island and finished up on the North Island, and it was an amazing month.
Excellent. And we're going to focus on the South Island just because we've done a show relatively recently on the North Island, where I spent 2 weeks 2 years ago.
Episode 240, if anybody wants to check it out. It was a good one. I listened to it a couple times when I was over there looking for inspiration.
Excellent. Oh, actually, we should say, since we're not going to talk as much about the North Island, you did a few things that I didn't do and didn't do a few things that I did do. You didn't do the Blackwater rafting, which was the highlight of my trip, going in a wetsuit in a cave with a inner tube and basically inner tubing through a cave underground. But you did do zorbing.
I did do zorbing, yes. A big, large plastic hamster ball feeling kind of thing where they put water in it, and that was in Rotorua, and they roll you down a hill. And I wasn't going to jump out of a plane, and it was unlikely that I was going to do any bungee jumping. So I had to do something that classified as somewhat adventurous, and that was what I chose to do. And yeah, it was a unique experience for sure. I just laughing hysterically the whole way down. It was it was a fun thing to do. They actually have the zorbing now right outside of Great Smoky Mountain National Park down in North Carolina and Tennessee area. I think the zorbing's actually in Tennessee.
And now zip lines are everywhere. So a lot of this is taking off, but certainly bungee jumping and zorbing, both invented in New Zealand, as far as I know. Certainly, yep. Bungee jumping. So let's talk about the South Island. What was your itinerary?
Well, I flew immediately into Auckland and then boarded a plane right away to Christchurch. I was going in the very beginning of their winter, and this was middle of last May. So it's going in the beginning of their winter. I didn't want to start on the North Island, and I thought if it's going to be winter, let's start in the coldest part of the country and work our way back north as the season goes on. So I flew into Christchurch and spent a couple days in the Christchurch area. I was talked by a friend into going inland on the eastern side of the island to Lake Tekapo, where I had basically a day of a washout. It was pretty rainy, and I didn't see much other than clouds and pictures of how pretty it was. I went south from there to Dunedin, where I have a friend, and he gave me an up-close and personal tour of Dunedin. And I also did the Otago Peninsula there, which is a kind of wildlife haven in New Zealand. From Dunedin, I went south around the south end of the island over to Queenstown, is what's known as the Southern Scenic Route. And there's quite a bit to see along that route. You could spend your whole 2 week trip just on the Southern Scenic Route. I spent a day in the Catlins, which was recommended to me by a blogger I know, and it was an amazing little corner. It's the very southern eastern portion of the South Island, and it's waterfalls and lighthouses and just really something you don't hear a lot about when you hear about New Zealand. It's not one of the places that gets a lot of publicity, but it was great. On the other side of the Southern Scenic Route is Fiordland National Park, where I did both a cruise of Doubtful Sound and Milford Sound. Milford Sound being the more famous, but Doubtful Sound certainly being good in its own right. From there, I went over to Queenstown, which is a pretty famous tourist destination with a lot of adventure sports and a very diverse region, a very pretty region in the mountains. From Queenstown, I went down to the rainy and soggy West Coast and drove up the West Coast for a few days, where any sun was more than I expected, and I did really enjoy the West Coast despite getting rained on quite a bit. And then after the West Coast, I drove inland up to the north end of the island, where I went to Abel Tasman National Park, and then kind of curved around to the other side of the island to go to a town called Kaitakura, a town famous for its whale watching. And then after Kaitakura, I went back up to Picton, which is the place where you catch the ferry across to Wellington and the North Island.
Okay. And now we'll do that again, but we'll do it a little slower this time. You flew into Christchurch, and obviously Christchurch has been in the news because of the earthquake there. And I think you found a city that is still very much suffering from the damage of the earthquake.
Yeah, the 2011 earthquake, certainly. I referred to it in my blog as broken, not destroyed. And I did have some people comment that might be too harsh. It's not a functioning city yet. The downtown area still has a large portion of it that is fenced off and called the red zone. It's a chain link fence around what used to be the very heart of a vibrant city. One of the cities that was always talked about as one of the nicest to live in the southern hemisphere. Well, one of the best places to visit is called the Garden City. And everywhere you go in Christchurch, there's a lot of chain link fence and buildings that are still in ruins, and so many condemned buildings. It's a city that has a great art gallery, which is open again. It also has a great museum. in the Canterbury Museum, which was closed at the time I was there, but I have heard is back open again. It's a very pretty place. It should be a very pretty place, but you can't get over the scars of the earthquake. And the residents there, the people I talked to, you can tell they still live with those scars of the trauma of the earthquake. And certainly they on Christmas Day the year before, they had what was actually a larger one in Richter scale, but didn't provide as much damage. The one that happened in February or the year later was pretty devastating. There were 180 lives lost, and the city's major landmark, the Christchurch Cathedral, was destroyed completely. Mm-hmm. So it was an odd place to start a trip. I will say that for sure. Outside of Christchurch is the Banks Peninsula, and if you look at a map of New Zealand, it looks like sort of like a little thumb coming off of the South Island. And if you look closely at it, you can tell it was a volcano at one point in time. The peninsula itself is perfectly round, and one side of it at some point in time blew out and filled with water and made a really unique natural harbor. And what the Banks Peninsula is most famous for is the little town of Akaroa, which is the port on the harbor. And people go there to swim with the world's smallest ocean dolphin, which is called the Hector's dolphin. They're between 4 and 6 feet long. And a company called Black Cat Cruises does a magnificent job of taking you out there. They don't do anything unnatural to induce the dolphins to come and swim with the people who are in the water. They simply just sail around and hope that the dolphins find the boat naturally interesting. And we were lucky because the few previous days to my trip out to swim with the dolphins, they hadn't had any luck in engaging dolphins. But the day I went out, we had seen the dolphins swimming at a distance, and they didn't seem too interested in the boat. And we were just about to call it and head back in. And Black Cat's great. If you don't swim with the dolphins, there's a part of your fee that's refunded. And if you don't see any dolphins at all, there's a larger portion of your excursion fee that's refunded. But we did see a group of six swimming, and we were just hoping, and we sailed around for a while, and they circled at a distance, and finally our guide decided, well, let's throw them on in the water and see what happens. They put you in the water, and she said, make noise, put your snorkel in the water and sing or yell or do whatever, give them some auditory stimulus to come and swim with you. And I did what she had said, was tapping the hard plastic part of my snorkel on my face mask. And within 5 minutes, I had one of these little dolphins just jetting right under my feet. It was an amazing experience because you don't pet them because their skin's very fragile, but you're still out there with animals who are in the wild who just are there because they find you interesting. And there are so many wildlife experiences like this in New Zealand. The Kiwis are so conscious of their environment. I was even more impressed by the fact that they have all this money on this excursion fees on the line, yet they're still not willing to try to induce the dolphins in any real way. And that was one of the experiences that I'll never forget, for sure. And that was the second day. So as I drove away from Akaroa, I thought, boy, this is the second day and I've got a month to go. How am I going to top that? From Akaroa, I had a day to play with on my itinerary, and the friend who I went to visit in Dunedin had said, well, if you've got a day, you really need to drive up into McKenzie County to Lake Tekapo region. And like I mentioned, I got up there, and it was almost complete washout. I'd booked myself on a scenic flight over the mountains and to see the mountains and the glaciers. And I sat around waiting for them to cancel the flight, and I'd also booked a stargazing excursion up on top of a local observatory called Mount John right outside the city. And neither of those things happened, which was a disappointment, but it also gives me a reason to try to get back to the South Island someday. From there, I did the long drive in a rainy afternoon down to Dunedin. And Dunedin is, I think Dunedin's probably 10th or 11th on the list of things that people will mention about New Zealand. And I just can't express how underrated Dunedin is. Dunedin is a college town. It's more than just that. It's obvious there's, with 110 or 120,000 people, it's more than just a college town, but it's the only place in New Zealand that has the American type college atmosphere. I mean, it could have been East Lansing, Michigan, or Stillwater, Oklahoma, or Chico, California. It had that feel. My friend took me right down to the University of Otago, and we walked around the campus, and it had the student housing. It was the only place in New Zealand that resembled that. And that was something that, had I been on my own, I probably wouldn't have gone over to the university just to check it out. But I was really glad I was with someone who showed me that. And Dunedin's pretty. It's a real nice setting. It's on a bunch of hills, and They have a couple of unique, really touristy things to do. I did a tour of the Cadbury Chocolate Factory, which was about as touristy as anything I've ever done, but it came with free chocolate, so I certainly lived with it. And then I also did a tour of the Spaix Brewery. Spaix is one of the largest beer makers in New Zealand. And while the beer is not the kind of beer that I like, the tour was interesting, and they did have a sampling at the end. It's one of those things where you can, they have a couple tours, one or two tours in the evening, so you can do your normal touristy stuff during the day and still have something to do, look forward to in the evening. And I just can't encourage people to visit Dunedin enough. The biggest thing about Dunedin was the Otago Peninsula, which is a little finger of land that extends out into the Pacific from Dunedin. And the Otago Peninsula is one of those amazing drives where I'm already driving on the wrong side, on the opposite side of the road. I won't say wrong side, but I'm the opposite side of the road. And this is only my fifth day of driving that way. And the road just snakes right along the harbor. You can see Dunedin in the distance, but you're following this little finger of land out there. And the road is so close to the water that the water, it was a very windy day and the water's lapping up onto the road, and I'm driving this small little camper van, and I kept thinking to myself, I'm blown away by the scenery, but I'm trying to concentrate on the road. One little thing, and there's no guardrails or anything, and you're just driving the front wheels of your car into the harbor there. It was a really, really neat scenic road. But as I mentioned, Otago Peninsula is famous for its wildlife, specifically penguins and albatrosses. Hmm. The National Albatross Center, the Royal Albatross Center, is out on the headland of the peninsula. And you go out there and you can sign up for a tour. And it's a place where they have specifically kept it predator free so that the albatrosses, which are, and I don't know if people are familiar with the albatrosses are similar looking to a seagull, except they have this amazing wingspan of sometimes up over 7 feet long. So they have the little body and these huge, amazing wings, which make them a great flyer.
But a lousy lander and takeoff, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why they spend most of their time out over the water. The babies that were there, the albatross chicks that were there, they're on land. They're born and they're raised on land for close to a year and a half. And then once they leave land, though, for the first time, they spend the next 4 or 5 years out in the ocean, not flying all the time, obviously swimming, sitting on the ocean surface some, but 4 or 5 years out in the ocean. So yeah, they're not really a land bird, but they need the land to breed. And the Albatross Center out there they very carefully monitor any kind of predator. So if they didn't, the Royal Albatross wouldn't be able to live in this part of the world, because the predators, and all predators in New Zealand are introduced.
Right, sure.
It's one of those places where when the first settlers arrived, there were no natural predators, and they brought them over as pets or to have them to hunt, and they started wiping out mass numbers of these New Zealand birds, a lot of which are flightless because there are hundreds and thousands of years of not having any predators on the island. They just forgot how to fly. Like the kiwi, the adorable New Zealand national bird, is flightless. But the most common killer of the kiwi is the household cat. So,
oh, cat. I would have guessed dog. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Cats and dogs as well. But you'll see that in a lot of places where you'll pull up and they'll have, this is kiwi habitat, please keep your dog in the car. Like I mentioned, their conservation is amazing, what they're trying to do. And they've done a nice job bringing back the numbers of a lot of these birds, but they're fighting an uphill battle against introduced predators, which I think we've seen from Australia too, that introduced predators do take a toll on our native creatures as well. After I left the Otago Peninsula, and I mentioned real briefly penguins, I didn't get a chance to see the little yellow-eyed penguins, which are famously come ashore at night on the Otago Peninsula. I needed to get further south to start my tour of the Catlins early the next morning. And I mentioned the Catlins when we talked briefly about the itinerary. The Catlins, again, is another place that doesn't get a lot of mention. I guess if people don't make it as far south as Dunedin, they go to Christchurch and take the famous road across to Queenstown and then go to Milford Sound. But you're missing the whole southeast corner of the island, which is the Catlins. And there are a couple really gorgeously set lighthouses. One is at Nugget Point, the other is at Waipapa Point. And then there are also a number of waterfalls that you can hike to. And it's got some other good hiking to coastline rock formations. And on a good, clear day, it's a good place to watch. You can whale watch. You can also see dolphins and a lot of penguins and stuff. I took the day to mostly do the lighthouses and the waterfalls. Waipapa Point Lighthouse, especially near the very southern tip of the South Island, has this kind of end of the world feel. It's one of these places where you walk out, you see the lighthouse, and you kind of walk out to the end of the land there, and you look out, and you know that all that's out there beyond that is Antarctica. So, I mean, you really do feel like you're just at the end of the world. And the day I was there, again, with New Zealand weather being so schizophrenic, I had a nice sunny part when I got out of the car to walk down to the lighthouse. And by the time I made it back to the vehicle, it was dark and overcast and just added to the whole, this is really the end of the world here. So it was a unique place to visit.
And you say Antarctica, and I forgot to mention when you were talking about Christchurch, but when we were in Christchurch, one of the things we did is we went to the Antarctic Center, which I don't know if it's still open for tourism there, but they do a lot of the staging for Antarctic expeditions here for one half of Antarctica here out of New Zealand. So
they do, yes, and that center is open. I did not have a chance to visit that when I was there, but it does get rave reviews. When I was in Auckland later on the trip, there's another Antarctic aquarium slash museum up there that I did have a chance to visit. But you look out there and you think, I desperately want to visit Antarctica someday. And I think, oh, that's, we'd have to long sail if you leave southern New Zealand to get to Antarctica. Sure. So, absolutely. Yeah. I spent a night in Invercargill, which is the biggest city on a very southern tip of the South Island. Mm-hmm. Invercargill is nondescript. It has a couple good museums, but it doesn't have a lot of sites. It's more of a place that you need if you need to stock up on groceries. It's a service center more than anything else. People who aren't camping will find the majority of the area's hotels are there.
And since you're talking about stocking up on groceries, you mentioned having a camper van. And yes. I think you had one like I did that's a converted minivan. So it's not a huge camper because it was just the one of you.
Right. Yeah, it was a great way to go around. Yeah, it was a perfect way to see it. They have different sizes. You were with Spaceship, I believe. And
right, I had
with
a Spaceship.
yeah, and I was with a company called Juicy, which I really, really recommend. They did a great job. And it was for one person, probably for two people, you could get by real easy in the Vanna model, which I had, which is that converted minivan. But they have bigger models. As far as the New Zealand roads go, I mean, you're not going to see the 53-foot RVs that you see here in the U.S. There's just that's not the kind of roads. They're not able to handle that. So the camper vans are all smaller, but you can get them with full kitchens. Mine had a small kitchen in the back, burner and a sink and everything. But you can get them with a full kitchen and also bathroom facilities as well. If true camping and using common facilities is not your cup of tea, which I did meet people who didn't want to travel that way, and that's fine. They have that available as well.
Well, I found in the North Island, I made no reservations ahead of time. And the time of year I was there, which was similar to you, I think I was there in July, so even a little more into winter, I didn't need to make reservations. I could just pull up to almost any campground, and there are a number of campgrounds, so it really wasn't that difficult to find a place to set up for the night.
No, exactly. And even at the time of year I went, the only time you'd probably really need to reserve your campsites would be during New Zealand's when the Kiwis themselves are out doing their holidays, which would be Christmas and the probably the 2 month stretch right after would be that's their summer, and that would be the height of their tour season. And you can tell by the size of these campgrounds that they have an active camping culture, no doubt. I mean, size of the camp. I mean, I'm sure you went to plenty where there were three or four of you there, but the campground could easily have fit hundreds of camper vans. And that's one nice thing about visiting in the off season. I mentioned the weather isn't perfect. It never really is in New Zealand, a country where you're never more than 2 hours away from the ocean. But I also got really lucky. I mentioned the one washout day, and that's really the only true washout day I had. I had a couple other rainy days, but those, fortunately for me, those were days where I was mostly driving anyway.
Well, and the first time we saw New Zealand from the air, we had just been in Australia for almost 2 weeks, and the contrast between Australia, which is a fairly arid place, and then coming over to New Zealand, which is very, very green, so obviously gets quite a lot of precipitation.
Yeah, it is remarkable how different those two lands are. I mean, a lot of times you hear Australia and New Zealand, just like it's all one word. But it is. You mentioned it perfectly. I mean, Australia, 80% of the center of the country is just burnt. It's just all desert. I mean, the coastlines, even the coastlines aren't similar to New Zealand's coastlines. Mm-hmm. Even the coastlines do have a more arid feel in Australia, whereas in New Zealand, everything, even in winter with some of the trees having shed their leaves already, it's still just a very verdant green place. It's amazing, the two lands down there together, because they are, there are very few similarities in the two islands, other than that I love both people. The Kiwis and the Australians are both, have both been wonderful to me in all of my travels.
Well, when we say winter, for me in the North Island, winter was like winter in California, not like winter in Michigan.
Sure. Well, it, the South Island was a little different.
Yeah.
The little cabana I had did not come with a, its own electrical plug, so I bought a device that allowed me to plug in, and I did buy a heater right away. After two nights of near freezing temperatures, okay, I was a little chilly. And then when I got further south into Fjordland, which we're going to talk about next, and also the southern part of the South Island, it was impractical. It, you could do it, and you could be nice and snug, especially if you've got somebody else in there with you. It's probably a little warmer, but I am from Michigan, and our winters are notoriously unpleasant. And I was a little cold sleeping in the back of a – and I can only imagine a month or two later what it would have been like. You could do it. Again, it would, you wouldn't, it wouldn't be horrible, but it's, it was a little cooler than I had, I'd wanted to. And as far as snow goes, I did see some snow, especially in higher elevations, but nothing along the lines of what we see here in Michigan or most of the Midwest would see.
Right.
So it just more rain than anything else. And I, again, my friend, when I booked the trip, said, oh, you're going to get rained on the whole trip, which was great to hear. And he was right. I rained 25 or 24 of the days that I was there. It just didn't rain all the time. So you take the good with the bad when it comes to the weather in New Zealand. And my friend told me, he said, they're a country obsessed with the weather and the forecasts and everything like that. And after 10 or 12 days of being there, I thought, why do you even try to predict your weather? It's just too crazy. The day in the Catlins I just mentioned, it started off rainy and sprinkles, and I get up for sunrise every morning because I think those make great pictures, and it was too rainy and overcast to get much sunrise, and an hour later it was clear blue skies and wonderful, and I was in the middle of a hike to a waterfall, and a storm blew in and rained on me, and then the next waterfall it was perfectly sunny, and by the time I made it to Waipapa Point it was raining again. That's what you got to expect from New Zealand. If you get a lot of nice days, just count yourself lucky. If not, bring a good umbrella, bring some weather gear, and just live like a Kiwi. Expect the weather to throw you a curveball every now and then. Excellent. And speaking of weather, that does lead me into Fjordland.
Well, and this is the part of the country that I have not seen that I feel most left out.
Yeah. Yeah, and this, I would say that this is probably my favorite part of the South Island. I went there specifically, and I'd read a couple articles online about Milford versus Doubtful Sound. Most people don't have as much time as I did to go there. Mm-hmm. So they thought, I'm going to have one day to go to Fjordland. What am I going to do? Well, Milford Sound and Doubtful Sound both can be done on day cruises. And when I say sound, I should explain, it's more like a Norwegian fjord than it is like Puget Sound in Washington State. These are, it's more mountainous, I would say, than Puget Sound, although Puget Sound has some mountains around it. I would say these are sounds where there's big mountains. They're mountains out either side, and they filled with water in between. So both boats that I was on take you right up to the side of the sound, and you can see the rock wall as it just extends straight down into the ground, and where it's filled with water, and it's incredibly scenic, and there are just so many different viewpoints. And Milford Sound was called by Rudyard Kipling the eighth wonder of the world, and it's pretty accurate. It's just so scenic. And I got lucky. I booked an overnight cruise on Doubtful Sound. I happened to get the last one of the year before it was winter and they stopped doing them. That cruise was with a company called Real Journeys. And it was on a boat called the Fjordland Navigator. And they have different types of accommodation that you can do. And I chose the hostel style accommodation because it worked best with my budget. But you don't really spend much time in your cabin. You spend all your time up on deck looking out over this fantastic viewpoints. And you take a boat over Lake Manapouri in the morning. They put you get on buses on the other side of Lake Manapouri, and you go up over Wilmot Pass and down into Deep Cove where the boats take off from for the Doubtful Sound cruise, and then you spend the day on the boat. They give you your meals, and like I say, most of the time I spent just up on deck watching the scenery as it went. And the first day I was out in Doubtful Sound, I had a really great weather day. It was mostly blue skies, and we were able to take the boat's kayaks out. I elected to do a small boat excursion where they take you right up and they show you the rock walls and they show you the plants that grow right into these rock walls. You wouldn't think they could exist there, but they take you right up close and show you that. And it was a wonderful setting. The next morning, however, when we woke up, Doubtful Sound had taken on the personality that you expect from these sounds, which was, this is one of the rainiest places on the planet. And there were a lot of low clouds. And most days when you're traveling, you get up and you see rainy skies, you're like, oh, well, that's disappointing. With this, it was perfect. I'd seen Doubtful Sound in good weather. Now I got to see it in its natural environment. And the low clouds gave it a real moody environment. After I got done with Doubtful Sound, that cruise, I got back into the town of Manapouri about noon, and I immediately drove the Milford Road down to Milford Sound. And I got down to Milford Sound, got to see that road. It was a cloudy, overcast day. The next morning, I did my Milford Sound cruise. It was sunny again with perfectly blue skies with just a few low wispy clouds covering the sound. And I consider myself really lucky. I spent 3 days there. I had the two nice days as bookends to a rainy day. So I got to see the sound in its natural environment and also in its the blue sky environment, which also makes for a little bit better pictures, I think.
Now, you say that this was one of their last cruises, if not their last cruise, and you were there roughly what time of year?
This was the middle of May. Okay. It was their last overnight cruise. They do them for, I think, 9 months of the year. Okay. And I actually sped up my itinerary a little bit so that I could get there. I had heard so much about the overnight experience, and it was unique. I was traveling by myself, so I enjoyed having people around, and I had dinner that night with a real nice group of Kiwis who invited me to their table after I was literally the last person waiting on deck to get the last of the sunlight photography, and came down and found all the seats full. So they invited me to their table, so I made some friends there, and it was a good camaraderie feel, and the company did a great job. The overnight excursions on Doubtful Sound, there's a couple companies that do them. Like I mentioned, I did Real Journeys. On Milford Sound, there are no less than six companies that offer day cruises. I did with a company called Southern Discoveries on Milford Sound only because I'd wanted an earlier cruise so that I could start heading back towards Tiana, which is the kind of central largest city in the Fiordland area. I'd wanted to get back there earlier in the day so that I could get caught up on grocery shopping and laundry and stuff like that, and also have time to drive the Milford Sound Road back and see what that was about.
And if you had been tighter on time and had had to choose between the two?
Okay. I don't know that you would see as much of Doubtful Sound in a day cruise. If you're going to do a day cruise, Milford is definitely cheaper and probably is more well-established. Okay. to be done on a one-day-only itinerary. And I think I stayed in the town overnight. I drove in and then did the cruise the next morning. And the town of Milford there was just a ghost town. I mean, there couldn't have been more than 200 people in that little area there at the night. But the next morning, of course, the tour buses start rolling in from Queenstown and from Tiano, and it fills up pretty quick. So Milford Sound's a pretty well-established. Doubtful Sound takes a lot more work. If I could do one experience, I would definitely take the overnight cruise on Doubtful Sound, even if it meant missing Milford. It was easily one of the highlights of the trip.
Excellent. Okay. And then from there, you say you drove back to the West Coast.
I drove to Queenstown first. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Queenstown because Queenstown is like an adventure cap. We talked about the Kiwis and their adventure stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do it. I did go out to where bungee jumping was invented. I took a gondola ride up to the top of a mountain which overlooks Queenstown, where they have a Maori, the Haka show that they have them all over the island. But I chose to do mine there. And they also have a restaurant up there where I had a wonderful buffet and was able to look at this pretty city overnight.
Now, at that point, they're really doing it just for the tourists because the Maori didn't live in this part of New Zealand. I think there was only one tribe at all in the southern island, and all the rest of the tribes were in the northern island. So clearly this is a tourism.
Yeah, it is. I don't think you're going to find a non-touristy Haka experience.
That's true.
But Queenstown had, like I mentioned, bungee jumping, skydiving, and parasailing, and all of this, and I just wasn't going to do any of that. And honestly, after being in Fiordland and the Catlins for the previous 4 or 5 days, getting into commercialized Queenstown was a shock to the system. It really was. When you're in Tiano off in Fiordland there, it's 4,000, and it is a dinky little town, and it's cute, and it's not real noisy. And you get into Queenstown, and it is it's just another world in Queenstown. When I drove in, I thought, boy, this is not going to be my scene. But I ended up liking Queenstown. I also spent a fair amount of time doing excursions in the area. I drove to a ghost town called Bendigo, which is about an hour drive outside of Queenstown, which I don't think a lot of people do because it's not real. It was dirt road and on top of a hill, and I didn't see another tourist while I was there. But those are the kind of dorky things that I do. So I didn't spend a ton of time in Queenstown. I should mention, I did go up the West Coast next, and that's where I'm going to head. The town of Winnaka, just north of Queenstown, also gets rave reviews. I did nothing more than a drive through and stop and took pictures of the pretty mountains, but Winnaka has a really good reputation. I just didn't have the opportunity to spend a lot of time there. My goal was to get to the area of the two glacier towns, Fox Glacier and Franz Josef Glacier, because the number one thing I wanted to do, and this was North Island, South Island, this was the top thing on my itinerary to do, was to get a flight over the mountains and the glaciers. And as I mentioned in Tekapo, I wasn't able to do that because of the rain. And I ended up staying in Franz Josef Glacier. And the day I drove up there was a very depressing day. It was rainy almost the whole day. I still did some hikes. I had a half an hour of clearing when I got to the Tasman seafront. But I woke up the next morning, it was still overcast. Now, I was willing to spend 3 days in Franz Josef Glacier just waiting for clearing to get this flight in. About 10 o'clock on the first day I was there, I started noticing some blue in the distance, and I immediately went to one of the flight companies and said, I really want to get up. Is there a chance? And they said, well, it looks good for about an hour. So I waited, and sure enough, they were able to get a plane up with myself and a couple of Australian tourists, and they took us right up over both glaciers, and we got to see Mount Tasman up close, which is the second highest mountain. By the time we'd flown over towards Mount Cook, which is the signature mountain in New Zealand and one of their most famous for sure, the clouds had rolled in again. And by the time we landed in the helicopter, the sea mist had again started to come back in, and I consider myself lucky. It was the only flight that made it up over the 3 day period that I would have stayed there. So I was really, really blessed to have that opportunity. And it was one of those things where I thought about this so much going into the trip. Getting off of that helicopter and walking back to the hostel I'd stayed at, I nearly floated back. It was such a surreal experience. And the Australians who I was with on the helicopter had never seen snow.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we were up in this mountain, and the snow came up to our waist, literally. We walked around. It was hard pack in a lot of places, so we were able to walk around. But they thought it was the neatest thing to just play in the snow. And it was a really unique experience. Not the cheapest excursion you're going to do, but I can't express how worth the money that was. Really, really just a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Later in the day, I did go down to Fox Glacier and do the half-day glacier hike, which is offered by a number of different companies there. And that was unique and informative. It's really the only way you're going to get to – they don't allow you to just hike and walk around on the glaciers themselves. If you're going to actually walk on the glaciers, you have to have a guide of some sort. That goes for either glacier.
Friends, sure. No, I imagine it's much more dangerous than most people would realize. So
yeah, it wasn't – it'd been many years since I put crampons on. So learning to walk in those again was fun and unique, and I saw more than one person who didn't quite get it and did fall down. And they said every year some stupid tourists decide, well, we're going to ignore all the warnings and go up there and do it themselves, and they fall into a crevasse or they slide off the side of the glacier, and people are hurt and killed every year doing that. So I knew better than to even be that stupid. I was going to just go and pay the guide fee, and it was a neat experience. And you can hill hike in. That's one of the things people do there, is they take a helicopter like I did. Instead of going up to the mountains, they take you and they drop you off in the upper reaches of the glacier where it's a lot more remote. And that's also expensive, but I would imagine definitely worth the money you could spend.
Interesting.
I finished up on the South Island. I drove up the West Coast, which I mentioned was real rainy. I had a couple days of on and off rain. I stopped in the gold rush towns of the middle West Coast of Ross and of Greymouth. Those were two of the towns I stopped in. I made a quick excursion over to a point called Cape Foul Wind, which you got to hand it to James Cook. He did a nice job naming some of these places. I had a nice sunny day. I didn't see any foul wind at all. Foul Wind is famous for one of its New Zealand seal colonies, and there's a bunch of boardwalks there that you can walk over and see the seals down below making all the noises and being just absolutely adorable, as most seals are. And that was a neat little excursion. And from there, I drove inland. I was cutting my way up to the north end of the South Island to Abel Tasman National Park, and I went through a beautiful stretch called the Buller River Gorge, which is, again, not a place that I hadn't really read a lot about it. And all of a sudden, I'm in this wildly beautiful area, which could be anywhere in New Zealand. And I made a quick brief stop at a national park of theirs called Nelson Lakes National Park, which was also pretty. But my main goal for the last 2 days I had there was to get up to Abel Tasman National Park and then over to Karakura. And Abel Tasman is, if you look at the map of the South Island, it's the very rugged northwestern portion of the South Island where mm-hmm. you go to one of these gateway towns and you get on a boat and they take you to a certain point along this coastal track. Now, you can go all the way out and take 3 days or 4 days to hike the whole coastal track back to these towns, but not being a great hiker and not kind of wanting to do that overnight thing and not having the time to do it, I did the day excursion where you take a boat ride out and you get to see the whole park from the water, and then they drop you at a point and you hike a certain amount. And I think for me it was 8 miles, and pretty rugged miles for somebody in my physical shape. So I did the 8 mile hike, and then the boat came back and picked us up on the beach and at another point. Abel Tasman was really unique, and it was another place that I'd left off my original itinerary. And I got so, when I put my blog post up about going, so many people said, "Oh, you're missing Abel Tasman. How can you miss Abel Tasman?" And after I got 5 or 6 of those responses, I thought, well, I better find a way to squeeze this in. And I was really glad I did.
I would say this is a good opportunity for it too. This is actually not the first episode we've done on the South Island. We did an episode on all of New Zealand before. It's probably 6 years ago or so by
episode
this point.
Episode 104. Yep. You
okay,
had
so
the,
5 years ago.
Travel people on right. Craig and Linda Martin.
And they hiked the Abel Tasman. So if anybody is interested in hearing more about the hiking experience, go back to episode 104. I appreciate that you've done your homework here and listen to that.
Oh, it's a great episode. And Craig and Linda are your classic Kiwis. They're such nice people. And I listened to that episode a number of times before I went. And they do a nice job in that episode covering the big highlights of New Zealand. In fact, I think I probably did almost everything that was mentioned by the two of them in that episode, because they're going to know better than anybody what to do. So, yeah, I did follow that. My final excursion on the North Island was driving over to Kaitakura, which is famous for whale watching. There is a deep water trench off the coast in the northeast corner of the island over there, where many different types of whales swim and do their migratory patterns. The day we went out, I was honestly a little surprised that they did put us out that day, because for a long time it looked like the weather was rainy in the morning, but it was very windy when the time came to go out. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't have a problem with seasickness, so I'm no problem here. And even when they put us on the boat, they said, if you've never been seasick, sit near the front. So I thought, oh, I'll sit near the front. But we went out there, and boy, I'll tell you, it was not what I expected. We were being thrown all around, and we did end up getting to see some big sperm whales, which was the whole point of the trip. We did see some dusky dolphins. The company that we went out with is Whale Watch Kaitakura, and they have a great reputation. And there's a couple smaller companies that do cruises in the area, but they do an information session on the way out. They show you what you're looking for and everything. And some cruises get a lot luckier than I did. We did see some sperm whales and dolphins, but I didn't see the amount of wildlife that I expected to, the number of dolphins and whales. And to be honest, by the time we gotten that signature shot of the tail fin of the sperm whale going into the water, I was ready to go back to shore. It was that choppy. So, yeah. And from there, I went to Picton, which is where you hop on the Inner Islander ferry and take it over to the North Island. That I remember getting on the ferry in Picton thinking, and I said it on my Facebook page and on my blog, I said, boy, I'd... good luck, North Island, living up to the South. Gonna have a tough thing to follow. And to be fair, I did love the North Island as well. But if I could only do one island, I would still pick the South Island.
Well, in my understanding, and having seen just a little bit of the South Island and really quite a lot of the North Island, is for overall majestic scenery, South Island. Cultural things, definitely North Island, because there's more of the history and culture in up there. And I loved the North Island too, but yeah, in terms of the fjords and the mountains and the glaciers and those sort of things, definitely South Island.
Yep, you just said it perfectly there. That's exactly the way you would summarize it. I mean, North Island has its beauty too. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have the majesty. The Southern Alps are they're not the tallest mountains. I mean, the U.S. Rockies are bigger. A lot of the Alps themselves are bigger. There's certainly higher mountain ranges in the world, but they are just so photogenic and just so beautiful. On days you can see them. Now they're covered in marine fog and rain a lot of the time, but the days you can see them, they're just gorgeous. And yeah, the North Island is wonderful as well. I mean, I only had 10 days up there, but I did enjoy the 10 days. Auckland is a huge – if Queenstown was a shock to the system, Auckland is beyond that, because Auckland's 1.5 million in a country that has only 4.5 million people.
Right.
So
more sheep. Certainly,
yeah, sheep everywhere you go. Yeah, sheep.
You had done a lot of preparation before this trip.
Yeah.
What still surprised you?
I kind of anticipated the question, and I was thinking about it the other day. I was trying to think what surprised me. Since I do so much preparation, I'm not really caught off guard a lot. What I find is I read things, and for some reason, I'm just too thick-headed to fully believe what I'm reading. And I had a couple of things. One is you said it in your podcast, and I'd read a lot of complaining about it from the travel blogging community before I went.
The bad internet.
Yeah, the state of the internet. It's brutal. And I'm not a real hardcore blogger that makes a living off of it or makes any money off of it. I like to update it so people have an idea what I'm doing, but it was almost impossible. Now, that was because I made a conscious effort to see more than blog. But
sure.
Even getting your smaller blog post published was a chore. And not only just
the banner. I found that from campgrounds, I could occasionally get a single photo uploaded.
Sure.
So, yeah.
And it wasn't just that it was slow. It was bad. It was expensive.
Right.
As well. So after a while, I got to the point where I just said, you know, I'm just not going to bother with this anymore. And I think the last 10 days of my trip, I don't think I updated my blog once. And I saw a huge dip in numbers, but I also saw a lot. And, you know, it's a trade-off.
It
the internet does stink, but you should be out sightseeing anyway. The other two things, yeah, I mentioned the weather. And you're never going to get over it there. I don't think you're ever going to have perfect weather in New Zealand. If somebody goes to New Zealand and has more sun and I probably did have a lot more sun and more clearing than I did rain. And my Kiwi friends all tell me every time I write an up blog post about it, boy, you were lucky to have that weather. Just I'd read about it, but I just – nothing prepares you for the absolute schizophrenia of the weather in New Zealand. I thought it was bad here in Michigan, but nothing to New Zealand. The third thing is – and I should have known this because I've met them everywhere and we've mentioned it a few times before – is how awesome the Kiwis are. They are so much fun. They are so friendly. They are just so overwhelmingly welcoming everywhere you go. I went to a small town. And the curator of the museum I went to see called her friends up to come up and meet me and talk with me about my trip in New Zealand. And they're just the most genuine people I have ever been around. They were so much fun. And just being by myself, it was nice to know that there was always going to be a friendly, smiling face. The cashier at the grocery store would say, oh, where are you from? How do you like New Zealand? And the minute you say something nice about New Zealand, I mean, you've got a friend forever.
Okay, here's going to be a hard one. You're standing at the prettiest spot in the South Island. Camera in hand, where are you standing and what are you looking at? And I'll give you three.
Okay, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I was good. I'm glad I did listen to that podcast on Yorkshire a few back because I did hear this question and actually had a chance to think about it a little bit. And I still don't have great answers because I could pull out pictures from about 30 different places. Well, I mean, Fiordland, we talked about. You're gonna get a signature shot somewhere in Fiordland, whether it be Doubtful or Milford Sound. And I'm just preparing a post this week for a photo essay on Milford Sound. And I was looking back through my Doubtful Sound pictures, too. And I'm like, wow, people say, oh, you're a good photographer. No, I just stand there and take pictures.
That definitely makes a big difference. Yeah, go pretty places point the camera in the right direction.
That's the thing about the sounds is you don't have to have a perfect weather day to do it. The clouds give it a very odd, moody kind of – the day I was in Milford, it was blue skies up top, but still there were wispy clouds in the sound itself. And yeah, okay. I mean, you can't go wrong.
So that's your first one.
Yep. Also, I love the view of the mountain range, which is like everything in New Zealand named perfectly, called the Remarkables in Queenstown. Hmm. It's just east of the town itself. It's a ski range and kind of an adventure sports area. And they're just the most fetching mountains. And I was on top of – I took the gondola up top to the other side on the mountains on the other side and was able to shoot across there. And the third one, I'm going to be generic here.
And I'm going to say anywhere along that coastline if you've got the right weather conditions. I have a couple of sunrise photos that I took. One over the Meraki boulders, which are these perfectly rounded boulders about an hour north of Dunedin. But my second day, my first real morning in New Zealand, I was out camping near the beach outside of Christchurch, and I had just the most magnificent sunrise over the Pacific. So you sunrise or sunset anywhere. And if you get the opportunity to view that, if the weather holds up for that, then anywhere you're watching a sunrise or sunset, New Zealand's going to be amazing.
And you mentioned interacting with the locals. So the most memorable person you met.
I'm going to steal up to the North Island on this one, because I did meet some good people on the South Island. But the most interesting person I met was a tour guide I actually had on the North Island. He, the tour early in the day that I wanted to get on was not able to go. And it only had myself and one another group of two people. So he said, come back for the 2 o'clock tour. And I decided to wait around. But he did sit around and we talked for a long time. And he gave me a lot of political insight into New Zealand, because you don't hear a lot about New Zealand politics, mm-hmm. and you don't hear a lot about the common people and how they feel about a lot of the land that's being given back to the Maori. And he was so open and so honest. And I had a number of talks like this, but he was by far the most honest person that I met there. And he was very upfront. And he traveled to America, so he was able to make some correlation to things that we have going on here in this country. And he was just – and they're all open and honest, but he more than anybody else. And he gave me 2 or 2.5 hours of his time. He could have – you know, he could have gone up and had lunch at the local pub and come back for the tour later in the afternoon. But we sat around watching birds at that spot, and just – he talked a lot about nature. And but I met people like that everywhere. The most interesting person, at one a day at least.
and we're going to wrap this up with fewer questions than usual, because this is already a long episode. Not quite long enough to split it into two parts, I think.
Well, let's just keep talking, Chris. Yeah.
One thing that makes you laugh and say, only in the South Island of New Zealand.
Sheep across the road. Sheep across the road. Turn in a corner, and you have the signs that say, watch for sheep. And actually don't even say that. They just have sheep on a sign. So you're like, okay, well, I turned a corner, and sure enough, there's a flock of sheep and a shepherd walking them across the road. I'm thinking, yeah, that's probably fair enough for New Zealand.
And your best money-saving tip for New Zealand?
Well, I would say self-cater. That would have to be the one thing I think that I saved the most money on. I don't want to say anything negative about New Zealand. And this isn't negative. So all my Kiwi friends, please don't hold me to this. But they do not have – they have good food, but they don't have a Kiwi cuisine, if you will. So you're not – if there are plenty of good restaurants that you can eat at, but you're not missing anything signature. Yeah, you should go out and have yourself a meat pie. You should certainly partake in some seafood. But the grocery stores are great. I went to a chain called New World most of the time, but there are plenty of grocery stores, and buy your own stuff. I mean, cook out. If you have one of these little camper vans like I did, you can open up your back. And I remember on the North Island sitting out next to a lake and watching the sunset over the lake and just grilling up some seafood that I'd got at the local market. It's definitely a way to save a lot of money.
I'd have to say I didn't get to the wine region, which New Zealand has.
I did not either.
I would definitely say it's a country that I would go to for the scenic beauty versus the cuisine.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Love the country. Would definitely go back. Want to bring Joan back. But I don't think of it the way I think of Italy or France.
No. And I don't think the Kiwis would even try to portray that. They do have great wines, I will say. And I think I told you about this because I did have a chance to see you right after the trip. I was unimpressed with the selection of beer there.
You said you were.
It's funny because when I got back, a week after I got back, a friend brought me over a beer from a company, a California company called Sierra Nevada. It says, this is grown with Southern Hemisphere hops, and they were all New Zealand hops. And I thought to myself, well, why can you have the best hops in the world and not do great beers? And since then, I've actually gone. I don't think the beers are horrible, just not styles I like, but their micro brew market's got a long way to go. But on the other token, if you're a wine drinker, you could spend a week in Marlborough, which is at the tip of the Southern Island, and also up, and there's wine regions in the North Island. You could spend time just doing that. And when I go back, when and if I get to go back someday, I do, even though I'm not a wine drinker, I think that that's one of the things I missed there was a tour of the wine region.
Finish this sentence. You really know you're in the South Island of New Zealand when what?
Well, for me, you've just gotten done photographing an amazingly beautiful overlook of mountains or the ocean or this prehistoric-looking ferns that seem to grow everywhere in New Zealand. And you get back in your car and 5 minutes later, you're pulling off again on the side of the road to get another picture. You don't travel anywhere fast in New Zealand. It's because the roads are crazy twisty in most places, but also because you're just simply trying to get over and get another beautiful picture. And that to me was the thing I'll remember most about New Zealand.
And before we get to my last question, do you have anything else that we have missed?
We did a pretty good job. You said it's a long one already, so I'll stick with what I had. I will say you usually ask about where you feel the closest and the furthest away, and I'll just real quickly mention.
But, you know, I always felt so close to home in New Zealand that I didn't ask it.
You really do, and that's the thing I wanted to say, is the influence of American culture there is so prevalent that you feel close to home a lot of times. The only time I felt far away is honestly when I mentioned kind of off the mic here a second ago about just being brought to tears by certain things, and there were a couple things that just – man enough to say brought me just to tears, that they were so gorgeous. And what I wanted more than – I was traveling by myself and I'm married and I wanted to get on the phone and call my wife, except it was 3 a.m. here. So I couldn't – that's when I felt farthest away from home, I think, because I couldn't pick up the phone and say, hey, honey, I just saw this absolutely gorgeous thing. I wasn't going to wake her up at 3 a.m. to do it. I was already lucky enough to get the month to go, much less waking her up at 3 a.m. So.
And what – 3 words would you use to sum up the South Island?
Friendly. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. People are wonderful. Scenic, because that's, as we mentioned, it more than cultural, it's scenic. And adventurous. You can bungee jump, skydive, you can find anything you want. Anything that, if you're adrenaline junkie, then the South Island of New Zealand's for you. And if you're not, it's for you anyway, too.
Now, Eric, you have a blog, which I don't know that you had last time you were on the show. So where can people read more about your travels?
My blog is On My Feet or In My Mind at blogspot.com. So it's that the title plus blogspot.com. I'm going to be removing the blogspot pretty soon, but I'm just 10 days into telling my little New Zealand adventures. And if you haven't heard enough of me talking here, I will be fleshing those adventures out for probably the next few months.
Excellent. And thanks so much for coming back on the Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your newfound love for New Zealand.
Thank you, Chris.
In news from the community this week, I heard from Adolfo, who said, Chris, I really enjoyed your episode on the European microstates. I especially liked the way the guest handled each one of them, not just explaining what's there, but telling the history behind these geographical oddities. I've been to Liechtenstein and enjoyed it tremendously. Downtown Vaduz, the parliament and the cathedral were particularly nice, and since I went in mid-September, the hordes of annoying tourists were non-existent. It is indeed the same as being in Switzerland, but the fact that you are not makes the experience somehow special. My wife and I want to go back to Venice one more time before our days are over. I will make sure to add San Marino to that trip. Thanks for your podcast. It is by far one of the best ones out there. And Adolfo, thanks very much. And we heard from Jim, who commented about the same episode in the Amateur Traveler Facebook page. We went into the casino at Monte Carlo without being too dressed up, although we were business casual. There's a room in the front of the casino where they have slot machines and video poker, probably intended for U.S. visitors, which is as far as we went. It's the only time I've ever won at slots. I believe the real casino that you see in the James Bond movies might be dressier. The real thing to see at the casino is the restrooms with super automated toilets. Can't explain, you just have to see them. Also, Liechtenstein was invaded recently. A unit of the Swiss Army got lost during a training exercise a couple years back and just wandered over the border, but they didn't take any prisoners. Jim, thanks so much. And this has been one of our longer episodes, so before we hit the 1 hour mark, we're going to bring this one to a close. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also comment, as Jim did, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/amateurtraveler, or follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.